Talking on devotion. It's the key to realization. Years ago, when I started off in the spiritual path, the word devotion was founded as some fanatical practice. And especially born and growing up as a Catholic, you know, you have to attend your morning devotion. Got pretty burned off. Because we didn't know what it really meant. Well, I followed the routine of getting up in the morning and doing the prayers, but it seemed so lifeless. It didn't seem to have any value. And then I asked the spiritual teacher at the time, what is really devotion that we are so supposed to be engulfed in, are supposed to give us all this great glory and wonderment and fullness, and I leave so empty inside? Said Mansoor Swami, devotion is like a man paddling a canoe down the river. So I started to think, what does he mean? Devotion is like a man paddling a canoe down the river. Didn't say anything else. Days went by and I'm trying to figure it out. All I can think of the river, the canoe, and the paddle up and down. Then it really dawned on me that devotion is the action we perform here and now. Not tomorrow, not yesterday, but here and now, the very act of lifting the paddle and lowering it, lifting it and lowering it, and keeping your mind on the destination so that the canoe doesn't crash into the rocks. But that seems very monotonous too, because lifting the paddle, putting it in the water, lifting it, putting it down, you get tired. But if you keep your mind on the destination, you notice that the scenery is changing and you're getting closer and closer to the goal. But it may take many days before you actually reach your destination. And you may look back and say, well, it's a far distance I've come, and I have a far distance to go. Is it really worth it? But then you lift the paddle, put it down, lift the paddle, put it down, keep going. And every day you're getting closer and closer to the destination. Then one day you arrive at the goal. You say, ha, what's the difference of this side of the road and the other side of the river? All I do is change banks. But you know, I learned something. By changing banks, I got my muscles strong. I'm not afraid to go back up the river. Devotion suddenly came to mean the strength in action. The strength you develop in action. Because emotion is a form of action that tends to dissipate you, tends to drain you, and leave you tired. And you really have no realization when you're tired. You're drained out. You don't go any place. Sooner or later you find you're fatigued and you wish you didn't get out. Because it's all the energy going out through the five senses into the outer world, getting involved. And for the wrong reasons. Not that energy shouldn't go out of the human being into the outer world and be involved. It should go out into the outer world and be involved, but it should have the right reasons for being involved. If we have the right reasons for energy going out of us into the outer world and being involved, we have realization. And then we can take that same energy and bring it back inside, internally now, and center it on the source of our being, where that energy really flows from. We have now devotion. It's a return to the source. Devotion does not question. Devotion acts and accepts. Since it does not question, devotion is a powerful force in its own right. We are asked by the great teacher Jesus to love the Lord with all our mind. Now you know, that's a very different thing to do. To love the Lord with all of your mind. Because when you're asleep, you can't love Him. Think of it. Sound asleep, you don't even know who you are. If you're a man or a woman, can you really love Him when you're sound asleep? Then you're only loving Him part of the time. And when you're dreaming, you're not loving Him. And when your mind is wandering, you're not loving Him. Because this is devotion going inwardly to the source. Then he goes on to say, to love the Lord with all of your heart. And you know, you have a heart that beats, blood pumps it through. And then you wonder, well, is he really meaning this physical heart, or some other kind of a psychological heart, or some spiritual heart? What kind of a heart is he talking about? The heart gives out sometimes, but it's the only organ that seems to be pumping 24 hours a day, in spite of the fact that we go to sleep at night and don't remember who we are, let alone cannot carry on the condition of loving God. This heart seems to go on pumping just the same. There must be something in this heart pumping all the time. And though we don't remember it, this heart don't seem to shut off. It still goes on pumping. And next morning when you wake up, you say, ha, I'm a man or a woman. Okay, Lord, I love you again. Be very faithful to me, heart. Then we start wandering all over the place. And he says, to love the Lord again with all your strength. Well, you know, if you don't breathe, you don't have no strength. Just think of it. The important fact about this physical body is the fact that you do breathe. And because you take the breath in, you have vitality. Now, years ago, I didn't believe that the breath had a lot to do with vitality and strength, until I was studying the martial arts. You know, today it's so popular in this country now on TV, Kung Fu and all this. Hey, watch out. But you can't really demonstrate these feats of strength if you don't know how to breathe. And scientists are relating this phenomenon and hooking it up to physical motion. They say a monkey breathes about 32 times in 1 minute. And man breathes about 14 to 16 times in 1 minute. And the turtle breathes about 4 times in 1 minute. And the length of life is predetermined by the amount of breaths we take in per minute. And if the length is predetermined, then that tells us how much strength we have in this mechanism, how much vitality that mechanism is going to utilize. So, right away, we begin to realize that if we breathe very fast, we can't be loving God, because we're going to get in a state of tension. If we start breathing slow, then the mind will get calm, and a peculiar thing happens, the heart slows down. And as the heart slows down, more love begins to flow. Now when you love someone, you're not excited, you're calm and collected, and you really glow and flow with that person, because you mean it, it's very sincere, very intense. In fact, when love is intense, mind does not wander, heart seldom breathes, seldom beats that heart, and the breath seldom comes in and goes out when you're so deeply intense in love. In fact, it would seem that you enter another dimension of behavior. Your whole nature, your whole soul comes into focus. Your exterior world seems to shut down. You become excluded from it. You don't seem to be identified with it for a while. If some doctor saw you in that state, he saw you're neurotic. And some ministers see you in that state, you're having a spiritual experience. And if your family see it, you better be put away in a madhouse. Everybody has a label for your experience. But you may not have a label for it. All you may have is the fact that you want to identify with this inner feeling and suddenly find yourself in that state. Love can create this peculiar phenomenon of devotion and lock us up inside the body and experience this altered state of consciousness. When we try to make devotion a daily routine in order to relate to the environment, it becomes difficult. Because devotion, like everything else, has its own peculiarities. It has ups and downs, it has periods of boredom, periods of doubts. You know, you ever went through a stage, you take a daisy, love it. It's the same thing. You go through the moments of that deep devotion, either you know what God is inside, or you feel it, or you don't feel it. And you're constantly going back and forth inside. Outside is more appealing, inside seems to be outside, and back and forth. Devotion can be very, very difficult to live with. Some mornings you get up, you take a deep breath. This is the day I'm really going to be devoted. And you run around. And you're all perked up, you know, and nothing goes wrong that day. And you really say, Lord is smiling on me, the grace of God is on me, I'm really doing this devotion. Boom, before night time comes around, dark cloud comes around, all gone. Next day, I don't feel to get up. And so, lousy rainy day, who wants to move? And then everything seems to fall into place. And then at the end of the day, you say, boy, it's not such a bad day, you know, God is really great. You start off wrong and end up good. And the day before you start off right and you end up wrong. Devotion now has got you all twist and turn inside. Where is this principle going? Where is it taking you? Some moments you may have a deep sense of the presence of the great master. and you can't go wrong. Other moments, there is no feeling, unlike if you're in a state of oblivion. Then you have to go to some spiritual person and ask them, how do you really make devotion work? Because by yourself, it doesn't seem to bring out more than just ups and downs. And yet, in a spiritual person, he seems to ride the crest all the time, going evenly through life, and he seems to have the key to devotion. He seems to realize himself. Then, from the very lips of the spiritual person, he tells you the very same thing you've experienced. He tells you the ups and downs, the coming and the going, and the different problems that he's gone through. He doesn't seem to give you no other information. So you say, why did I come to you in the first place if it's the same thing I'm going to learn? And then he smiles and says, that's all there is, friend. You have lived it. Since you have lived it, you know what it is. Now you can share it. Then you take it, figure out. Maybe there's more to living devotion than talking devotion. Maybe there's more to the actual day-to-day, moment-to-moment confrontation with one's own physical self, one's own mental attitudes, one universal outlook, because the devotion is suddenly pressed out from all these problems, from all these confrontations. You seem to squeeze out a state of feeling, a sense of being that seems to give you strength. And you wouldn't trade it for anything else in the world, because you seem to be able to live with it for the first time. You are living for the first time with the insecurity. God, the divine love, is the cosmic insecurity. But you have found how to be secure in it by all the confrontations in your daily devotion, in your daily living. You don't want to trade it now, because you can walk out in the midst of the street and see people who are caught up in the fear of trying to be secure. And there is no security to come from their security. And yet God, who is the eternal insecurity with the life flowing all the time, is offering them security by the very confrontations they are experiencing, by the very process in which they are living, when they can't seem to relate to it or express it or even squeeze out or extract the strength from it. It doesn't take long for a businessman to learn devotion. He opens his store, fills it with stock, and then walks in the first customer and asks him for something he hasn't got. He got every other thing but that one thing he forgot to buy, or he didn't buy it, he didn't deliver it. He learns pretty fast that with all his conscious mind, having all the things prepared, here comes some individual who wants what he doesn't have. After a while, the businessman, if he's going to be upset, he'll buy everything the customer comes and asks for, which he doesn't have. Before you know it, he's not selling anything. But he has to take the chance that the store is open and there are going to be customers who are coming to buy the merchandise. And then he can book the orders for those that he doesn't have. To show you again how devotion works, devotion doesn't necessarily mean that I bow down on my knees or kneel down in front of some statue and pray all day. Devotion is a process. It's the inward movement of yourself that makes realization of life tangible and workable. When I was working, you know, every day, like everybody else, you look at the clock, how soon you want to go home. So this becomes the routine of devotion. Once in a day, figure out when you get up at 5 o'clock. 2 more minutes before the clock, boys. And this is the usual routine for you, go on like that. Putting out energy and trying to conserve it before the clock goes off. After a while, you find out that you're living according to the clock. You're not living it from inside. So every day you say to yourself, I wish I owned my own business. I wouldn't be putting up with all this nonsense. Mm-hmm. I'm going to punch the clock, do this, and get all this back, wash from this boss, And all you try to do for them is give you another. So in your mind, you're constantly thinking, I'm going to be my own boss. In the meantime, you're collecting your paycheck faithfully every weekend. But you got to trust him that he's going to have that paycheck there, because when you went to work, he didn't tell you he was going to pay you. He says, you're going to work for me? Good, I'll give you so much a week. He didn't say when. But you have to take him and trust. So you're devoted. You put in all your effort into it. And yet, in the process, you're hating the job as mad. You get out of the job. You open your own business. Now you're not looking at the clock. Your eyes are on the door. When is the next customer coming? I've got to pay the rent. I've got bills to pay. So there's the devotion changing now. You're turning up all inside of you, waiting how to make this movement. In the meantime, the inward power of God's self in you is allowing you to wake up. That if you trust this principle within and center your mind daily, it will gradually bring into manifestation the things you need. Now, years ago, if someone had said to me that in business for yourself, you can really live the spiritual life, I'd say you're crazy. I'd say only a monk who has renounced the world can really live a spiritual life, because he would know how to generate real devotion to the spirit. But to be involved in business, how can that generate devotion? Where would that be possible? You're too tied down in mundane things. But you know, I've never seen any church that didn't run on money. They all operate on a financial basis. But here's the interesting thing. A business has commitments. And the scriptural life is that if you don't make a commitment, you can't have more. There's a parable in which a man was given a certain amount of talents by the Lord, and he went out and doubled it. And then another one was given another amount, and he went out and doubled it. And then the third one took his and hid it, and the Lord took it back. Here we have a very important lesson in devotion, because it is teaching us how to trust, how to venture forth in the divine life and move from within our nature and gain the strength by living it moment to moment. Many years have passed, and in our own work with the fellowship, we have seen the demonstration of this devotion work. We have our commitments at a certain time of the year, every 3 months. And you know, we don't have the money in the bank to pay it 3 days before. So everybody is uptight. They pray hard enough, because they're worried about it being not on time. All I do, I write the check, date it, and put it in the envelope and tell the secretary, now you mail it on that date. And say, Lord, don't make it a hot check. I can do my devotions, I love you. Everybody here loves you. It's up to you to do the rest. In a strange way, over the years, we've come to call the devotional life photo finish. Everyone has had this particular experience now and can see how they have been living the spiritual life and did not recognize it. Photo finish right at the last minute, and then it gets pretty hair-raising because you don't even have a penny to pay the bank charges. But then you tell the Lord, oh, look, Lord, I don't mind having photo finish experiences from you, because this is really the devotional life, but how about a little to spare and a little to share? Nobody rides his car without a spare tire, because that's another form of security, another form of expression of devotional love. So if the divine intelligence can bring about manifestation in our lives, photo finish, then it can bring it about photo finish with spare and a little to share. Why should it not do it? No farmer plants his soil and reap the whole harvest and sells the whole thing and have none to start next year. So you have two examples to tell the Lord, as it is in heaven, so it is on earth. You got him over the barrel. Well, naturally, he's a very well understanding person, and since he made us, anything that we would try to do here, he already wanted us to do it, but we don't want to take the credit. You see, Oriental people like to talk to their Lord on a man-to-man basis. And when they get a good scolding, they walk away like little children. That's how they get the devotion going in it. That's why they're often accused for being fanatical at night, or tend to be over in the direction that is excluding the environment. But they're not excluding the environment. They're really learning to reach that trust from a process within themselves and work with it. They're devoting their whole lives instead of part of their life. They're making their whole entire inner workings centered on life, God. And there is no moment in the life that is excluded from this process. Now, in the book of Psalms, in the second verse, the second verse, it tells us that man should meditate on the right law. You know, some people came to me one time and says, the Bible doesn't talk about meditation, how come you're talking about it? And all the Oriental teachers that come in this part of the world, they talk about meditation. I said, oh, well, you read the Bible? I said, yes. I said, well, how old is the Book of Psalms? Oh, that's very old, older than the Maharishi that came over here. Well, read what the Book of Psalms says. So they're going to take it out, and there it is. Meditate on the right law. And then they don't read any further. I said, what happened? Oh, it says day and night. I said, what? Day and night. He says, well, you see, 24 hours. You've got to be meditating 24 hours. Your whole life has got to be centered. And meditation is not just sitting and closing your eyes. It's the process of bringing this devotional nature up. That all action is devotion. All action tends to relate to life as a whole. And it's the key that releases you when you center all your consciousness on this particular principle. Business is the same, that's a form of devotion. The church is the same, that's a form of devotion. Any type of activity in which you're centering your whole nature on is a form of devotion. The only difference between the spiritual and the non-spiritual is that the goal of the activity is centered on God, the supreme giver of life. We don't center it on the mere business, we don't center it on the mere fact that we are human beings, or we have commitments and responsibilities. We center it on the principle of life itself, God, the force that flows within us. And if we center it there, then we begin to experience what is called the fatigueless state. You know, I used to work from 8 to 5, and 4:30 I'm tired. And in between the day, I need to brush up the 7-Up and so forth. By the time 5 o'clock comes along, I'm heading for the highway and back home, and all sweaty and irritable. But getting really nowhere till the next morning, start the whole process over again. When I got into business, my eyes are glued to the door, looking for the next customer. And I would close up too soon because I don't have enough in the cash box to account for the day's activity. So I was working for less money, longer hours, all because I wanted to be in business. My goal orientation was the business. And the other one, I was working less hours, but my orientation was the time and the clock, how much time I'm giving to the other man. This began to show me that when you have the wrong orientation or goal inside, you can't really function properly. And true devotion or true dedication of action for life must be centered on life. As I got into the spiritual work, I realized that there is where the dedication begins, centering it on God itself, the main spring of all activity. From that day on, the fatigueless state began to occur in my body, a state which I never experienced before. I would push myself years ago to try to do things, but get exhausted. And then, when dedicating my whole consciousness, internally and outwardly, towards the real mainspring of life, the fatigueless state began to appear. This is the fruit of the devotional life now. Life abundantly was what the Master said, I have come that you may have. I have come that you may have life more abundantly. It didn't mean material objects, though that will come by virtue of magnetic relationship or effort. But he meant a flow of life force, a flow of life energy in the body that would seem to lift you out of the norm of behavior in an altered state of awareness that for the first time you can function without being impeded by fatigue, tiredness, restlessness, and anxiety. This fatigueless state begins to appear. So someone will say to you, you are blessed. I don't say you're blessed. I say the first time I ever discovered how to be humble. Because the orientation of my mind is to the divine principle and not on myself, and not on the other person who I'm going to do some work for, and feel that he's cheating me, therefore I can do less for him. No. I'm centering my whole being for the first time on the divine principle. Then, in the words of the Master again, he who would lose his life for my sake will have it back. You see, he's talking of life, effort, the output of energy. If you sway and throw your whole nature into that particular orientation, point, goal, objective, for the divine principle itself, it'll come back. That same quantum will come back to you and double. And the evidence would have to be a fatigueless state, a more acute, sensitive state, a more aware state for the first time. The things that were not obvious to you begin to become very apparent. Realization begins to occur in your nature. On a formal level of developing devotion, some of us may not be aware of how to soften the nature of ourselves because we have a harsh exterior. Certain environments don't seem to appeal to us, therefore it becomes difficult for us to relate in terms of devotion. When we go to a church, the environment is designed for devotion, because there's a sense of beingness there and attitude that is being maintained there. You walk in the church and there's an altar, and it makes you aware that this is dedicated for some purpose. But you may not feel devotion. You may just walk in and sit down like everybody else, or you may feel devoted and you may have some obedience to it in consciousness. Then all of a sudden, the choir would sing. You'll get up, you'll take part in it, but you don't feel no elation. And you look around in the crowd and you see people highly elated with what they're saying and doing. And then you say to yourself, how come they can feel so elated? What is it? Am I more intellectual than them? Or am I that dead in sensitivity that I can't relate? Maybe I'm more intellectual. That don't prove nothing. Maybe I'm dead sensitively, and that still I can't relate. If I can partake and feel this joyous moment that these people are feeling in this environment, then there is something that is working from inside me, that is bringing out life, bringing out more of life, that I can really devote myself to. When the minister gets up or the priest gets up to give the sermon, some people are enraptured by it. Others are not. I've heard it before, heard it again, same old story.
You're telling me anything new? All right, he's telling you anything new, and to others it's very new, because the first time they'll be hearing it. Yeah, those who are hearing it for the first time, they say, well, that's a different twist than the last time. Or the person who's hearing it so many times, they find different ways to look at it. As far as devotion is concerned, the first time or many times, are you feeling any joy inside? Are you feeling any sense of balance, peace? If you are, then it's working inside of you. Now, the minister comes down or the priest comes off the podium, then the pastor plays the run. And there again you go into a mental tantrum. Same old story. They're all the same. They talk all about heaven and hell and everything, and this pastor plays the run. Nobody seems to be happy. And you're all torn up inside. And some are happy because they want to give. And you look around, you're asking yourself, what is it all about? Then at the end of the whole ceremony, the minister is at the door greeting you. Then you're walking up and you want to tell him a piece of your mind. You want to ask him a question, but you don't know which to do. So ask him the question, why is it you're wasting your time here? Or is there anything here for me that I can find peace? Is there any logical shortcut way that I can find peace? But you don't do either one, you just shake it and you walk on. Well, when you begin to reflect that devotion is not involved in telling the priest off, or minister off, or to ask him for some shortcut. Devotion is involved in living. The attitude that you take to the experience, and that the experience is to bring out in you a sense of love. That's all it's supposed to do. And this is where the devotion gets its strength from, the sense of love. So the next time you go back to that church with that particular attitude in mind, it doesn't matter if they sing Rock of Ages or Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, the sense of love to sing, because man wants to sing somewhere, and there's no better place than to sing in the church, if you can't sing in the opera. Or in the battle, sing someplace, but get the tune, let it out, release it, don't feel inhibited, don't feel shut down, clamped in, or shut off from life itself. Life is for living, life is for experiencing, life is a devotional glow, it's the joy of existence, and this is the real devotion that comes, that opens the door for you, to be yourself. You come in and you sing with the choir and the congregation, and you feel that emotion suddenly dripping down and then devotion rising up. There's a sense of belonging, a sense of unity, a sense of togetherness is occurring. Then as you listen to the sermon, you don't listen just because he knows more or he knows less, or it's the same old sermon. You're listening now for the first time to a human being that is a temple of the Creator. And this creative principle is passing through him. That is the sound principle, the voice, the ideas that make up a language that are put together to mean something in that frame of reference. These things are passing through. You're trying to make it relate as a nature to which you can be one with. So you are looking at this particular process. And you'll find the priest or the minister will be saying, I of myself can do nothing, but the Father which is in me doeth everything. And if you really look at yourself and ask yourself that same question, who can really do anything if he doesn't have life working inside of him? Can you move your hand if you don't have life? Can you blink your eyes if you don't have life? Can you say something to me or to yourself if you don't have the life to do it, the vital power? The realization will come now. And it's by this internal observation, regardless of what the priest or the minister is saying, or the rabbi is saying, the joy to see a human being effectively projecting life force, God, relating. You can see the same thing at a business meeting, or you can see it with a PT, what do you call it, parents, PTA. Any place where you see the human being is relating, you are seeing the devotional life working too. Not merely in the church, it's in every aspect of it. it begins to widen your whole existence. Now, when it comes down to the holy ceremonies in the church, like the communion, for some people it's just another ritual. For others it's a mystical experience. For the man who is doing it, it might be a chore too. For the time I thought the same thing too. Take the bottle, put it there, pick it up, put it in. It's like a chore after a while. But again, it's how you are relating. If the devotional feeling of love is strong and centered, the Holy Communion now becomes not just a ritual or a type of a chore for the person performing it, but it becomes the first tangible experience of an altered state of consciousness for a person who is devoted. He can have the experience of an altered state of consciousness, something that will uniquely expand the sense of feeling and joy in him, because he is partaking in a principle that is vitally alive from the very moment it was presented to mankind, all through time. And the aliveness is in the participation. The aliveness is in the renewal of the bond. That's where the aliveness is, because the moment you renew that bond, you are lifted up again, you are enlarged, you are altered out from the restriction of your own thinking into another dimension. And if you are very, very humble, you can have the extrasensory experience of perceiving the angelic beings that stand over the altar while the ceremony or the ritual is being performed. You can see that divine light pouring into that chalice. You can see the Christ Self permeating the whole room. These are the blessings that come from an intense devotional heart to perceive this. Mystics who have spent their lives in deep meditation and devotional activity all vouch
as human beings must make the contact. It's the basis which we must generate our own devotion from. Without that physical expression or physical contact, we don't have a way to generate devotion. We will always be generating more emotion, more anxiety, more tension. These rituals will appear in time and disappear in time and will come back. Why they come back is because those who are devoted inside, those who can retain the bond, the covenant, make it live. And will make it live for anyone who is sincere, because he can see the altered states, he can see those levels for the first time. Devotion to the Lord begins by accepting the principle of God in all things. If we accept this principle of God in all things, then we automatically get the glow, the light, the flowing, and the love starts to move. The mind now does not fall asleep. It does not go into states of forgetfulness. When you close your eyes to pray, or meditate, or contemplate, there is no more drifting away, because it's centered for the first time. The glow is coming up. The inner warmth is coming up. The body is relating for the first time. Consciously, subconsciously, and superconsciously. That means on an intuitive level. It begins to perceive in an altered state. That is why a great teacher said, Master Jesus said, those who have eyes to see, let them see, and ears to hear, let them hear. They were granted the opportunity of an altered state via the eyes and via the ears. Their intenseness of being centered upon Him or the divine principle allowed devotion to flow through them. And they were able now to relate and experience something that is great and universal passing through the body. And even the disciples, when they partook of the various rituals, they had altered states to perceive what was going on. Today we are getting more and more involved with altered states of the mind. All the universities, the research centers are doing tremendous research inquiring into the consciousness of mind. And as we inquire more and more, we will find sooner or later that we will have to come back to a devotional life, because the evidence is mounting up. The evidence is piling up so fast from all levels of research that the devotional life is the only real life left for man to follow. The emotional life will tear him down and finally destroy him and degenerate him. Yet the devotional life will revitalize him. It will give him a sense of unity with the whole and build back his spirituality. In the East, this has often been accepted as the way of life, but even there, they also get clouded up in their own ideas. Now in the West, we are also reaching for that particular experience. And more as we reach for the experience, it will begin to open up for us. We're coming into a period of the year in which we're going to celebrate a very wonderful holiday. And when I was a little boy, I used to call it eating the buzzard. Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is a very devotional experience which the whole world, let alone this nation, or man himself, finds himself involved. The art of giving thanks. It doesn't have to be one day in the year. Neither does it have to be one particular group of people, maybe performing some type of a holiday. The art of giving thanks is the highest expression of devotion that a human being can apply himself to. If you have no other concept of what devotion to God is, or relate to any of his marvelous expressions in creation, the art of giving thanks would take precedence over all of them. When Yogananda, the great yogi, had lived in this country, was alive, he was often asked, what is the greatest devotion man can give to God? What behavior man can really offer to God, who he can see, who he must take on the faith of others' intuitive awareness, and the writings of men who have passed on, what we as laymen can do? And after a long while, he said, the highest art of devotion to God is giving thanks. He says, nothing else takes precedence over that. He says, you can spend many hours of praying and meditating, it will still not take precedence over the art of giving thanks. Because God created us all. God is embodied in all of us. And the art of giving thanks is accepting the reality of his existence in us. And this devotion is a living devotion. It has no creed behind it, no philosophy, no dogma, but it takes precedence over every creed or dogma or idea, because it is man to man, man to creation, man to the whole, living for the first time on a conscious level in a simple manner as a child and yet adult. A child says thanks and we are elevated. We say thanks to another fellow man and we are elevated and they are elevated. This common bond is the highest form of devotion in action. If we take that bond and unite ourselves in harmony with our fellow men, then we erase all the anguish that are generated from inside. Well, you pick up your paycheck, how many times do you say thanks to the boss? And then the customer comes in, how many times do you say thanks, come back again? You see, by virtue of this behavior, we are expressing the highest aspect of devotion to God. Even when we pray, you know, as a good Catholic, I wanted something, I'll go and pray in front of a particular saint and ask him for something or her for something. they help me get through my needs. But when I don't say thanks, I don't get it. And every time I say thanks, it happens. So, but you know, when you're learning, you don't know how to relate. When you reach a certain state in your spiritual understanding, and then a spiritual teacher places what I call it, full stop over the I, or dotting the I, in other words, giving it significance in your life, then you begin to see the truth of the purpose of giving thanks to all things. Giving thanks is acceptance of things happening before it even happened. It's the acceptance of a miracle to become a miracle. Giving thanks is accepting the Lord and His abundance before He even showered on you. Because the thankful heart is the true devotional heart. And there is no one left out who is fully thankful. So the scriptures say, sing and give praise to the Lord. Sing His joy, sing His glory. Be thankful. Have the thankful heart. The thankful heart is the highest devotional behavior a human being can bring out of himself. Thank you.
About a 5-minute break, and then there'll be a question and answer period. And following the question and answer period, for those who wish to remain, we'll have some more chanting and a short meditation.
Now, initiation is the ancient baptism that Jesus went to John for and asked him to baptize him. And John says, no, you baptize me. And Jesus says, no, you baptize me. And then picture for one moment two adults trying to throw water in each other's head. The word comes from, to mean, introduce. Introducing you back to the audible life current in your own being. And it's very, in all the religious ideas, we have to be introduced to our own nature at some point, at an adult level. It was intended in the early church that the Godfather performed that particular introduction to the child when it came of age. But then it lost its true significance because we never did pursue it. There are only 5 basic disciplines that one follows in spiritual life as an initiate, because the 5 forces that bind us to this creation are water, which is liquid, earth, which is crystallizing or solid, fire, which is thermal, air, which is gaseous, and ether, which is sun. Our nature is tied up in these 5 forces, and 5 deadly sins mentioned in the scriptures are locked up in those 5 forces. Greed is the earth force. Lust is the water force. Anger is the fire force, and attachment is the air force, and ego is ether. The great Guru Nanak, who was the founder of the Sikh religion, when he was alive, he said, I can conquer the wild beast, I can materialize anything I would like to eat or wish. I can do many things. My consciousness. But where is he who would deliver me from the 5 deadly sins? Where is he who would give me the discipline to control these forces within my nature? Greed, lust, anger, attachment, ego. The discipline is involved in initiation, introducing you back to yourself, how these forces are resolved. And therefore, at initiation, we are told how to resolve the forces. And Jesus, by virtue of the same thing, had to go to John to asking for that same person.
And when John blessed him, John perceived the Holy Spirit descending on him. That is what initiation involves. It's a ritual that came down all through the centuries involving connecting us back to the God Center. Christianity is not new. Very old religious science, and more it's becoming aware, and people are recognizing that there's more to Christianity as a science than just their lip service begin.
Jesus gave a very simple answer for that when he was asked, teach us to pray. You know, if you ask a person to teach you to pray, then you really don't understand the purpose of his existence or his ministry. Because his ministry would be meditation. His whole life would be telling of a process of how to arrive at the realization. And then all of a sudden, to ask him how to pray, then it betrays the ignorance of the individual who does not understand what the teacher is offering them. He is giving them a whole process of living for 24 hours, and then they turn and ask him to teach us to pray. But he tricks them, and he makes them work for their realization by giving them certain principles to adhere to. And the second verse is one of the most unique principles that he gave them. Hallowed be thy name. Now, certainly God's name is not God. And don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, that is the second commandment too. So if his name is not God, or if his name is God, then God would be. But hallowing has a lot to do. That means you have to be centering your mind on some particular sound or name. You have a name, I have a name, everybody has a name. Some particular thing to which we relate to. The sound currents mentioned in the Holy Scriptures is often termed the Word. In the beginning was the Word. In the very onset of creation, audible life current was present. And the Word was with God. The audible life current is in the creative principle. And the Word was God. The evidence is centered upon the Word itself. The audible principle, the audible life, is God. It's called the Shab or the Naam by Indian mystics. In the West, it is called the Word or the Divine Audible Life Stream. Now, once you relate to that level, then you have to hallow it. That means you have to be constantly thinking of it. The right law means to think on it, rotate it in the mind, let it go on in the mind, so that the mind doesn't scatter itself, it gathers itself together. We have that process in the West here by the practice of the rosary. You can say the Hail Mary, Our Father, anyone, providing you are repetitionally doing it. It's in the repetition that the evidence of this work or force is working. For those who have done research on the brain and observe how the brain is functioning under repeating the rosary or repeating any mantra in the Eastern thinking, they have seen that the brain leaves the beta level and enters the alpha level of the constellation center. Now, if it doesn't do that and just merely once in a while think of something, it fluctuates all the time. So the mind is scattered and the energy is not really going any place. So hallowing the name of the Lord is a form of spiritual practice, and it's one of the techniques of meditation to help the individual to center.
First Christian baptized.
disciples of Jesus. See the word Christ or Christ.
I mean, from what race used the Christian baptized first? This is what I mean. My question is that.
Well, when you say Christian baptism, let us clear up what we're saying. Is the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost that baptized you so-and-so? Is that you're referring to?
No, my question is not that. My question is, what race, what nationality used this Christian baptizing first? Who made the Christian baptizing first? What race used it?
Well, the race would not be involved in a principle like that, because this principle came down through time right into the Middle Eastern countries. Baptism is an Eastern word, it's not an English word.
Yes, but who used it first?
It's not the Hebrew people used it first. It was brought to them by John the Baptist. They were not the first people to use it. The idea was brought to them from the Far East. You have to trace man back into time, and man has been on this planet for quickly over 2 billion years, they say. So as far as who brought it, there is no evidence to link it up. The oldest writings we have of a baptismal practice is in the Vedas. The Book of the Vedas is the oldest writings in the world. And they were practicing that initiation. Now it came down, as far as we know it, from the organized church. It blessed the child and put the water in his head. But this is taken off from John the Baptist, carried over. But John the Baptist said, I baptize by water, but there come one who baptized by spirit. As far as nation or nationality, we can't say the Hebrew people were the first, because this principle came down through time. We have no evidence where it started. All we have is the recorded fact that Baptist John was going about doing this particular ritual. He was not the originator of the ritual. So we really don't have any recorded history of which nation began it. All we can have of the idea of baptism occurring in man's writings dates back to the Vedas. Now, the word baptism really means initiation, way back in time. If the three wise men didn't follow a star, how would they get there? Follow something, and the star led them. They said, "How did they follow UFO?" But you see, the man Herod made a remark that these are not only wise men that came in search of Jesus, they were also kings in their own right, in their own kingdom. And a king does not get off his throne to go visit another individual that easily, unless there's some higher understanding at work. These kings came from a far country, further than Palestine, they came from the Far East. They would have to know some type of knowledge besides astrology to guide them to that point. And they would have to have some purpose of bringing him specific type of gifts. And anyone who would receive a gift, I don't know who would not question the origin of it or the donor of it,
or the giver of it. If you're a little child growing up and your mother says, these gifts were brought by three kings, what would your imagination do? Would you not want to go look for them? It's the most natural thing for a human being to want to find out where these gifts come from. The years of the Master Jesus from 12 to 18 is not in our present written scriptures, but they have found manuscripts to date that he had to be someplace. And those who have read the Aquarian Gospel by Angus Levi, who gives his account from a muddled, altered state of consciousness, tells you where Master Jesus was during this period. But on a human level, if I was a human being, and I've been told by my parents that these gifts were brought by some individual from a far country, it would fire my imagination to want to go and see them. Because we all got the Huck Finn in us for the Tom Sawyer. And we've got to take off and go find out for sure. Yes, we have taught that.
And
it does a lot of things that takes care of.
I thought very
initiation or baptism does not eradicate anything. It prepares you to face yourself. It prepares you to face yourself. God created man in his own image and likeness, male and female created him, gave him the power to have dominion of the universe, and God took off. As far as becoming invalids or sick in this world, it's all our fault, not his. We can't blame him for a single thing in this environment, or any injustice imposed upon us. What we sow, we reap. And we are the molder of our own destiny and thinking. As we think, that is what we are. It's very hard to accept that it's the cold facts of our life. And Father, forgive them, for they do not forgive them. There is no condemnation in God, and only to the Son is given the power to judge, not penalize. Only the Son can judge, but he doesn't penalize us either. And the Father doesn't condemn us, so what do we have left? We have to be thankful that since the Son does not penalize us, can only judge us or point out to us our misdeeds, and the Creator himself does not condemn us, then by virtue of our own behavior, we are going to pay the price. We pay the price through our own behavior. This is the penalty. You reap what you sow. If a devotional person do what? Yes, they can. For instance, when Jesus met John, he addressed John by telling the crowd, not born by the will of the flesh. That means there was no craving in the form of the flesh that caused him to be born. There was no condition in that flesh form that caused him to be born. He had no personality craving in it. There was nothing to which he was owing from a past account. Nor was he born by the will of his parents. The parents couldn't know what John the Baptist would look like, even if they wished for one or craved for one. He couldn't crave to be born by any misdeeds performed by his body. But he was born by the will of the Lord. It's God's craving that, or God's desire that John come back into the body. That this principle or person who is called John be born. And therefore he is taking on certain responsibilities by taking on that condition. We must first establish if you have a soul or if you are a soul before you can say it enters the body. Do you have a soul or are you a soul? Do you have a soul or are you a soul? All right, then your scriptures are totally wrong. God breathed the breath of life into man and man became a living donkey. A living tree. Well, it doesn't say that he became a living, but so he doesn't have. He is. Man has a physical body, but he doesn't have a soul. Man is soul. Soul is a composite. It's a composite of a physical body of 16 elements, an electrical body of 19 elements, and a causational body of 35 elements, and they're all in the atmosphere right here. Soul is a composite of a body comprising of 16 elements, an electrical body comprising of 19 elements, a causational body comprising of 35 elements. I'll show you what you mean, or what I mean. If I take flour, raisin, shortening, water, and bake it, what would you call it? What is bread now? Is it the raisin? Is it the bread? Is it the flour? Is it the water? Is it the shortening? It's a label for something that is concocted there by the heat. Here is a concoction by the creative principle. He made us in his own image and likeness and infused it with life. And the life is what gives it this peculiar movement or dynamism and call it soul. We call the finished product a name, bread. This finished product is called soul. So man is soul, he doesn't have a soul. The finished product is bread. But is bread flour? Is bread water? Is bread the shortening? Is bread the raisins inside? It's neither one. They're just the ingredients that make up that particular name. This is the same thing. We are a 16 chemical mechanism, an electrical mechanism of 19 elements, and a causational mechanism of 35 elements. If you take the flour, the water, the raisin, and the shortening and cook it, and you call it bread, and keep it on the shelf, you still call it bread. The day you bite and eat it, where is the bread gone? It didn't go no place because it was nowhere. It was always there. It's only the flour and the water and the raisin, nothing amalgamated together, now breaking down inside your intestinal tract. You mean say the bread is gone someplace? The bread can't go nowhere. It was always there in the first place because you classify that particular object as bread. It didn't go into energy either. We are an image
God made us in His own image and likeness. Male and female created them too. You see, no woman's liberation has to come in the picture. But He breathed into man this mechanism, the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Research is being carried on right now to prove what they call soul and what is called spirit. And we're coming to the realization that we don't have a soul, we are soul, we are the label. But the force field that enters the body or leaves the body is measurable. For the first time, we can measure a diminishing loss at death when the person ceases to breathe. The body seems to weigh 3.5 ounces less when you stop breathing at death. Now, the scientists who made this discovery after many experiments classified that diminishing loss to be soul. That's what he called it. Until his colleague said, you can't call it soul because you don't know if there's a 3.5 ounce expansion when the baby was born, when you cut the cord. You have to go cut the cord first, and before you cut the cord, take the whole baby and put it on the scale and see how much it weighs, cut the cord, and then see how much it weighs after. If it's 3.5 ounces, then we can call that power that goes in there something, but we can't call it soul even then. So when he did this, there was a definite increase of 3.5 ounces when the cord was cut. So he doesn't call it soul no more, he calls it this, the breath of life or spirit. And this is being done now at the research, etc. So here we have the situation now. If this particular increase in weight occurs when the cord is cut from the child, then people begin to think now, have I really killed anyone if I commit abortion? There is no increase in weight when the object is taken out of the mother. Until the cord is cut, then there's an increase of 3.5 ounces. And when it ceases to breathe, it has to breathe. They have found oxygen flowing inside, and it may appear to be breathing, but still, when you cut it, that unseparated distinctly from the mother, it weighs 3.5 ounces. Whatever is that force that enters there to give it 3.5 ounces, that is a deciding factor today, or will be the deciding factor in the future, as to whether man is committing a homicide or act of abortion, before or after. Before the baby is born in the womb, or when it's actually born, and there's some force that enters there to give it its own importance. Now, when it dies, there is a definite loss of 3.5 ounces. So, to say that is soul coming in and going out, you can say yes. We know it is not the soul, because the soul is a composite force. It's this particular force field that holds the whole thing. It's like you say, bread is a name for all the parts that you put together. Flour, water, raisin, and shortening. Now, when you mix the whole thing, your flour, your water, your raisin, your shortening, it may weigh 1 pound. Put it in the oven for 45 minutes and take it out, and then there's a loss of a few ounces. You don't get a whole pound back. Something has gone out of it. The moisture. See, equally true in this mechanism. When they cut the cord, there's an entrance of energy from the nostrils into the lungs that gives it an exact 3.5 ounce over from the weight that they extracted from the mother. And when they stop breathing at so-called clinical depth, this is not cosmic depth, clinical depth. Clinical depth from the standpoint of the physician, measuring pathological measurements. The body weighs 3.5 ounces less. See, cosmic depth is an entirely different thing. Cosmic depth is mentioned in the Bible by the Master Jesus when he heard of Lazarus being dead, you know. He said that's not a death unto the dead. That is only a pathological condition existing in Lazarus. The real death hasn't occurred yet. We appear to go through pathological changes, physiological changes at depth, where 3.5 ounces is dissipated from the body and then it breaks down.
Why is the temple? Why is the temple?
matrix is a temple. The matrix is a temple. The matrix is comprised of a chemical body of 16 elements, an electrical body of 19 elements, a causational body of 35 elements. This matrix is the temple of God that holds these forces together. Thank you very much. We'll take about a 1 minute break while we're setting it up. And we'll have some meditation. Okay?